First of all, just recognize that actually a whole industry is built around keeping you in a box where you lack the confidence to do it yourself. You can easily master this by some self-education, and then you will start recognizing, oh my word, but all these messages I've been sold that it's so complex is actually not true. It's quite simple to do it yourself. You should be a DIY investor. You don't need a finance degree. Like, you can invest your own money.
You're listening to the Fit Mom Podcast, and I'm your host, Marisa Tully.
And me, Ash Iovino.
Our conversations on here go beyond fitness, diving into hormones, sleep, stress, biohacking, and the latest science-backed systems.
Our biggest passion is helping ambitious moms like you channel the same drive you bring to your work and family into your own well-being.
Carla is on a mission to make wealth building simple and accessible, teaching you how to invest. She's a chartered accountant with an MBA, global experience from Switzerland, UK, Netherlands to South Africa, and she's also the founder of the fast-growing investment education platform, Money with Carla. In this chat, we dive into how you can unlearn old money beliefs, start investing without overwhelm, build wealth on your terms, even if you've taken a break to raise kids, and how to create a financial system that actually fits your lifestyle.
Okay, let's get into this conversation today. So I'm very excited for us to start chatting about how we can empower more women to invest. I've had the privilege of getting to know you personally as a friend, and there's so much that you can teach us. And so before I get into all the questions, I think let's just get straight into it, because the listeners don't have as much time. We've got a lot of mothers listening, a lot of corporate moms, and ambitious women who don't necessarily have the time. So a bit of a quick summary of your background and how you've gotten to where you are today, because I think a year and a half or a year ago, you were not doing what you're doing right now, and you have done an incredible job with building the Money with Carla community. You've got over 50,000 Instagram followers that also came more recently, over 12,000 YouTube subscribers. I think I'm just quoting you. It is a money podcast.
It's accurate.
It's a money podcast, so I have to throw some figures. And over about 10,000, I think, newsletter subscribers. So you've done an amazing job, and I think your story is so inspiring. So if you can share how you got here.
Yeah, sure. I think, just telling the story is really crazy for me, myself. I can't actually believe what we've done over the last year or year and a half. I started Money with Carla with an Instagram post in January last year, just coming back from maternity leave. I don't think I've actually told you this like before, but I was my son was born July the previous year, and I was going back into my corporate job. I worked for an investment firm in Switzerland, and I just like didn't feel going back. I think once you have a child, you realize that the trade-offs are massive. This is not just going back to earn a salary. You're actually paying someone else to bring up your child. And I just didn't feel that the job was worth that for me. So it really made me question. I think a lot of moms can relate with this. It really made me question like just life in general, and what do you actually want from this? And is this a high paying job really worth it? So, but I was desperate to do my own thing. I mean, I have like a lot of ambition, and I want to do my own thing. I just wasn't sure what. So I went on a walk one day, and I went through therapy sessions at the time, because I was so stuck in like super, I had a lot of fear about taking a next step and starting a business. I went for a walk one day. It was on a Sunday. It was the day after my birthday. Yeah. The 20th of January. And I went for a walk, and I was like, God, like, if you're not going to do this today, you're never going to do this. When you get home, you're going to design like a little template for your brand, and you're not going to ask anyone's opinions, because as soon as I get opinions, people are like have conflicting ideas, and then that just make me even more fearful. So I just decided, okay, I'm going to make my first post, and this is how. And I posted it, and I started a new page, so I didn't like carry over any of my personal followers. And I told my husband, look what I just did. And he was so, like, so very supportive. He's like, oh my word, that's amazing. But it's like such a cringe photo if I go look back at it. But anyway, this is how it started. And I actually want to tell that story, because I think a lot of people can relate with that. The only thing that I did different is I took that first step, and I started that first post, and it was super cringe. It was not perfect. But like, if you want to start something, I would say that first step is probably the biggest like hurdle. And in terms of what I did over the next year is, I focused on really just creating content that people wanted. I asked people, what do you want to learn more about money? But I initially thought it would be more about budgeting and saving and more like, yeah. And then it ended up being a big focus on investing because I realized a lot of people don't understand investing at all. I thought everyone had like a general idea of what a smart investment is and watch out for fees and you can actually do it yourself. And then I realized many people don't, including many chartered accountants that worked with me. And anyway, okay. So I think that's kind of the background on what I started doing. In January this year, so it's like 6 months in now, almost 6 months, I launched my first course. So I didn't really monetize my channel or my audience until January this year. And it like exceeded all my expectations. The amount of people that signed up and how valuable they found my like course to be. I actually, if you told me this last year, I would have never believed it would have turned out this way. So, but also feel like I don't want to celebrate it too soon because what if it doesn't stay this way? What if it doesn't continue to grow? So I'm very much like, don't say too much yet. Yeah, just wait and see if it still continues. You know, I don't want to celebrate too soon. I actually kept my corporate job in Switzerland until September last year on a part-time basis. So I asked them if I could phase in my return after maternity to give me a gap to still get a salary, but also to grow my audience. And that really worked out well for me. But I mean, we can also talk about side hustles for moms and then what kind of advice I would have around that. But yeah, I think that's like the story.
That's so inspiring. But also just to answer chip in there where you said you don't know if it will last. I think that is very much still the fear that when one starts off on your own and then entrepreneurship, like self-doubt, but like what we've seen on the outside and the value that you constantly give, you're just going to grow. Definitely.
Yeah, and you know that self-doubt is, I think every entrepreneur goes through that, but it's not spoken about enough. Mm. Because I went through, like, now you see, okay, lots of followers, a course and different upcoming courses that I'm going to, that helps monetize. But I went through, like, really dark days by myself, and I had to shoot YouTube videos. I have no idea, like, how to do good scripts, how to shoot well, how to, you know, get an audience. I had no idea what I was doing. I literally just found an editor on Upwork, and he helped me edit something, you know, in 2 days to get a video out. But I was like very lonely, no guidance, and very dark days where I thought, what did I get myself into? This was a big mistake. Multiple times. So yes, it was really like not an easy journey. And what you see now does not reflect or, you know, I think exactly that story is not told enough because a lot of people go through it and they're like, why did no one tell me it's going to be this hard?
Yeah. Or they look at what you've done and they just see a series of you showing up on video and think that they just have to put themselves out there and talk and then that the following and the money is going to come, which is back when I used to run a PR company, I've worked with so many influencers and so many of them didn't know how to monetize their channels and they had massive communities, but they don't, I'm going off on a tangent, but they don't get an income because they do trade exchanges. And also, yeah, that's a conversation for another day. But having witnessed your drive and your ambition and having the privilege of also having a poiki with your family and seeing the strong woman that you have in your family, I'm really interested to know more around how you grew up when it's around conversations about money and about like what you're going to go study and just what that environment was like that shaped you.
Yeah, I find this topic very interesting. I love trying to understand how childhood shapes your thoughts and your actions and your ambition. And something in my family kind of worked, I think, for entrepreneurial spirit in some way. Like, I can't put my finger on it, but I've got 3 siblings. So we're 4 kids and all of us are entrepreneurs. My dad is a doctor, so he followed like a conventional path. And my mom studied as a teacher. She worked for a bit as a teacher, but then she brought up 4 kids, but also always had side hustles. So she would do nails at home and then she sold like Avon, you know, that multi, is it that, I don't know what yes, you call it. Is yes. it still around? I don't know. Yeah. But, and then she also sold jewelry at a point. Anyway, so she always had these like side hustles where she would make money. But I, like from a young age, always try to sell stuff to try and make money. So we would go to the beach. I would come back with some shells and then see if I could sell them through the gate. Like, yeah, I just wanted some extra money to go to the tuck shop. And my parents were quite, well, my dad was very frugal when we grew up, because, he had four kids, of course, and my mom worked a bit, but, I mean, she didn't make a lot of money. And we could go to, I remember we had a Wimpy in the town that we grew up in, only a Wimpy, and like this a random pizza restaurant, but we could only go to the Wimpy once a month, and we loved going to the Wimpy. And when we had a prize giving, we could also go to the Wimpy. So sometimes it would happen like twice a month, but it was like the biggest outing that we had in the family. And my dad was just very, anyway, very frugal. So it kind of forced us to find ways of that we can bring in extra money ourselves. But he also, my dad was really, well, it's my sister and I. So he had like two daughters and then a big gap and then two more, a son and a daughter. He never made us believe that we can't do, like, we can do everything. He basically said, he had this famous saying, who are the people? We are the people. Like, don't care what people think, because we are the people. And just go out and do anything. I really think, because I didn't grow up with, my dad is not like an alpha male. He's not very dominant at all. He's like, just, who cares what your gender is? You could do what you want to, and like, go play with the boys. Or it was never this thing of, oh, but this is a girl's task and this is a boy's task. That was never, because I only had a sister until the two other siblings came. So I think that very much shaped our way of seeing things. But also in terms of what we studied, my dad just said, you can study anything. Well, not anything. I'm like, you can basically go and study something, but don't study medicine. And I could have literally studied anything, but due to my dad's influence, he said, you're not going to study medicine, because this is not a great, it's not a very scalable career. In his, like, not specific words, but scalable wasn't a word back then, but he encouraged us to become business people. So he said, if you study as a CA, you'll definitely be able to be a businesswoman. And that kind of encouraged me to study accounting, but then that got me on a 7-year commitment to become a chartered accountant, because you study for 4 years and then you article for three years to become a CA. And it's highly regarded in South Africa, but you also get very easily stuck in this road. And it's really hard to, like, really hard to make a change. It took me a move to London, to the Netherlands, and to Switzerland, a very expensive MBA, to eventually actually move out of that strict path. So for me, it was really hard. Mm-hmm. But anyway, now I feel like I'm telling you my whole story.
I love it. I get so inspired by it. But also, I think a big part of why you have taken the leap, of course, it comes from you and that decision after those dark periods, but also you're having such a supportive father and your mom as well. When we were having conversations around the table, revolving around starting businesses, she was so for it and so motivating in terms of, so I think bottom line is you've got this great support from your family, and that's actually something that I can relate to at the age of 25, when I also came back from London and moved back into my parents' home because I wanted to start my own business. And I just knew I was also deeply unhappy and really wanted something new. And just knowing that my parents, I mean, after 25, I moved back a few times and they helped me out. But just having, like, everyone's got a different entrepreneurial story. And a lot of times you hear from people coming from nothing and absolute struggle, but just being so determined.
And I think we shouldn't underestimate the power of having a backup as your parents, for example, that's able to help you out. Because in my mind, I'm like, okay, obviously I'm desperate to make this a success, but if it doesn't work out, at least I can always move back into my parents' house, even though I'm married with a son.
Like, and they would, in our 30s.
And in our 30s, they would always be so welcoming, number one, but also they have the financial security to also help us if we need to. And I think that safety net really enables me to take big risks, where if I didn't have that and I literally could not come, you know, if something goes wrong and everyone's reliant on my income, I would. So I really, it's not as easy for everyone. And I really think that it's a big, I'm in a very privileged position just because I have backup from my parents.
So not everyone's in the same position, but there are also other ways, not necessarily to become an entrepreneur, but what we'll talk about is side hustles. Mm. And then also what everyone should be, a lot of our listeners are all in a position to save and invest. So we'll get on that.
Okay,
so money, very, very, it's deeply emotional, and we all have inherited our different money stories. Do you have any advice for those women who are a bit, who are not confident, wanting to take those first steps, basically? I even, just looking at myself, I couldn't have this podcast conversation in my 20s because I think the topic itself, money, completely overwhelming, and I'd be very afraid to sit opposite you and trying to think, how do I actually sound like I make sense? So yes, let's touch on the confidence and any advice that you have for women wanting to start.
So I think that I'll get to the advice now. I want to like touch on why women have this idea that they can't invest their own money. I think if you grew up in a house where it was very much there were traditional gender roles, then it's quite hard to break out of a role where money was only discussed amongst the boys, or your dad would discuss something with your brother, for example, but never with you, or your mom was never involved with a discussion on investments or on money with your dad. Then it's quite, if you grew up in the environment where, okay, this is not a female topic, then that's probably the first barrier to get over. But I think that in terms of lacking confidence to start investing, because I'm very much you should be a DIY investor. You don't need a finance degree. Like, you can invest your own money. Being, you know, that lack of confidence is across the board. It's across the board. It's not only females that feel that way. And I think that this is really the lack of confidence is really something that you can, first of all, just recognize that actually a whole industry is built around you keeping you in a box where you lack the confidence to do it yourself. There is a whole industry that sells very complex products, that puts a lot of noise out there, that promotes the complexity. Trust us, you don't know what you're doing. We know what we're doing. We're so much better. And this is how they build massive businesses around charging you fees on your investments so that you trust these big, big firms, or you need an advisor, and you think that you can't figure it out yourself. So this is not all, it's not all you to blame, but you can easily master this by some self-education, and then you will start recognizing, oh my word, but all these messages I've been sold that it's so complex, it's actually not true. It's quite simple, you know, to do it yourself. And I think if I would say that in terms of the courses I run, I usually run confidence course because I have a confidence score before and after the course, because I think that literally the biggest driver of people taking control is the confidence part. And I try to put things into simple, simple terms, because it doesn't have to be that complex. You can actually break it down into a very simple, like, step-by-step way. And I would always say, so like tips, DIY investing tips is, if you're in South Africa, you should have a tax-free savings account and you should invest that money. Like, that money should be invested. A lot of people have a tax-free savings account, but they're actually not sure where it's at or what it's in. If you have a TFSA with one of the big banks, very likely it's only earning interest and it's not being invested. So I would say open a tax-free savings account that you can invest in stocks, in international stocks, for example, an S&P 500 ETF or an MSCI World ETF, which gives you international and global exposure. And in South Africa, that's a 36,000 rand a year annual limit, or 3,000 a month if you want to break it down monthly, and 500,000 over your lifetime. But I guess many listeners would say, well, I have more than 3,000 to invest. Then I would, depending on your age, I know that retirement annuities are quite a popular product for tax advantages in South Africa. I don't want to go on like a whole investment product spiel, but I wouldn't say retirement annuities necessarily make sense to every individual. Mm. The tax advantages make them seem quite lucrative, but they are invested more conservatively, especially if you're young. You should take more risk. And the second thing is, they can be very high fee products because, yeah, they get promoted a lot. So if your advisor is pushing you into an RA, there might be a lot of layers of fees. But I've got a lot of videos on fees, so go and check that out if you want to understand that better. I don't know, is that a good
tip? Yes, it's a lot. So, okay. If I just think of a friendship group and a lot of the women that I work with and coach, a lot of them have got RAs. So if they were, and some, I'm assuming, and actually I shouldn't make that assumption, because the fact that we say a lot of people have tax-free savings accounts, I still chat to friends who still don't have tax-free savings account, nodding in the background, yeah, on the team. So what I actually wanted to say though is RA versus importance of tax-free, and then also a platform that you recommend, like Easy Equity. I'm not sure what's the one in the UK, Trading 212. There's another one. Anyways, How do they go about that? So you've got your RA and you're wanting to make sure that, let's just speak to the listeners who don't have tax-free savings accounts. Would you recommend they go onto these platforms like Easy Equity, look at the tax-free savings options like investing in the S&P 500? Mm-hmm. Or if they want to be, nothing should be too safe. I shouldn't say inverted commas safe. Go to a bank and look at assistance there with tax-free. Because I just know that this is a very... I know we're making it sound basic, but I know some people find it quite overwhelming.
Yeah, so I think that there are a lot of platforms that make it easy for you, right? I am hesitant to promote a single platform just because, like, in general, I feel that I don't want to link too much of myself to a certain brand to yes. say just this one, because there are many options. I would rather want to empower you to go actually and explore the options and then decide for yourself which one you want to go with. Okay. So Easy Equities is a very easy one to use to open a TFSA with. But you can also host or use Easy Equities for your RA. But when you use an RA on the platform, for example, it's much more expensive than a TFSA. So I don't want to say Easy Equities and then everyone's like, okay, I'm going to move all of my investments to Easy Equities because then your RA there is expensive. So I don't want you to use it for your RA. But it is a potential option for your TFSA. Okay. I love Signia, which is a company in Cape Town. I used to audit them when I lived there or when I worked at KPMG. And they are also big promoters of index investing. So they've got indexes in South Africa that they allow you to get exposure to international indices like an S&P 500 or an MSCI World. They can also, you can open your TFSA with them and kids' TFSAs with them, but it's not as easy as it would be with an Easy Equities app, for example. And they've only got a web-based platform, but they've got better customer service. So you can actually call them up and say, I'm struggling with this, or what's going on? Why is my money not on my account yet? With Easy Equities on the other side, the customer service is what I've heard, not that great. And personally, I actually don't use either of these. I have no interest in them. I don't get any, yes. kickbacks for promoting them. There are other options too. I mean, in my course, we literally go through 20 options and we look at 20 different fees on all of these platforms, the pros and the cons of all. And I personally use Interactive Brokers, but that's an international brokerage platform. And it is quite complex to use, but... Anyway, that's what I use. So I actually don't use either of those.
Okay. No, that's good to know. And I think I just wanted to drop some names there because I think, again, people have got no idea. They go, where do I even start when it comes to opening up a tax-free savings account? Or how do I even get to invest in S&P 500? So I think the answer there is do your course.
No, what I would say is probably first start and open an Easy Equities account and open a TFSA and put some money in there and do it. Just because this is like a learning journey of, I would say, at least 6 months to go from zero to euro. And I would rather have you figure this out and start doing it, because you don't have to do my course. You can, I honestly think you can probably figure this out yourself if you do enough research. You can figure it out. I guess doing a course is probably just going to save you time, and that's why you want a trusted source and you want to save time. And that's why people would do something like that, right?
Yes.
But I think get started. Just do it, put 100 rand in or 500 rand in and just get some confidence. Because then when you take a course, you'll probably even get more out of the course because you've seen some of the things.
And you'll be more motivated to do all of the different chapters and videos. I sent you a while back this is also a way of actually getting some confidence, even if it is a platform like Easy Equities, where they give you demo funds. I showed you a screen grab of my demo US fund that was up 400%.
Yeah.
And I was like, darn it. But I don't regret it at
all. But
it's
I think
interesting. It's fun. I'm enjoying it a hell of a lot more.
Okay, that's amazing. Yeah. And it's super empowering. I actually don't check in on my investment portfolio often just because I'm a passive investor.
Yes.
Once a month at least, I give an update to my subscriber base and I share an update on my portfolio, how it's doing against the index and what's happening in the market. So I actually am forced to go and check in then to see how my investment portfolio is doing. And I absolutely... It's so empowering. It's so cool to see that I'm actually making money and my wealth is growing without me actively doing something there. This is like really being a passive investor and just trusting the market to do its job. But I mean, for someone that's not familiar with passive investing and indexes, they might not understand what I'm saying. But I have very cool free videos on YouTube. Just go and watch them.
So many. Yeah, we don't have to go into detail there. Yeah. But just on that, when I was on maternity leave, that was so rewarding because, of course, entrepreneur, you have to somehow pay yourself on maternity leave. Seeing the growth and actually making more money than I would have 1 month than at a company on a percentage of maternity leave. Anyways, okay, so another question that I wanted us to quickly just touch on is circling back to side hustles and those women who already feel like they don't have a lot of time, which I also, I mean, that's just perception as well. I think if we really put our efforts and goals towards this, we can always make the time. But what are the sort of side hustles that you've seen working moms take on, or any ideas or inspiration that you have for any listeners that are looking at sort of getting a side hustle just to earn more and potentially invest that?
So I would, I mean, this is an interesting point because I always want to go back and kind of use my personal journey as an example and just like how amazingly well it's been. But I have been doing it full time since October last year. But before that, it was a side hustle, I would say. I think one piece of advice, if this is possible for you, is to say that I'm going to try and move part-time and take 1 day a week away from my full-time employment so that I can spend that 1 day focused on my side hustle. But even before you get to that point is to try and test some things. And like for me, it's online education, I've realized, is actually there is a lot of potential there, but finding a niche in something that one you are actually passionate about, because it's not always going to be fun and you really have to like talking about this topic because you're going to have to think of content ideas and also obviously design a course where you have value to add that people can learn from you. And also I think, but it doesn't have to be online. It can also be testing out, I mean, baking. My little sister started a massive business baking from home and doing brownies and fudge. And now she's employing 14 people and it's a massive business. She's got a little factory. And this was really just starting at home and baking brownies and fudge. But she was also forced, because it was during COVID, and she was kind of forced to start something because she didn't get into her honors program. So she was like, okay, but what am I going to do now? Anyway, I think that's one thing. And also, like, I want to encourage people to really lean into their strengths, because I think this is where you can differentiate yourself from anyone else in the market. Is if you ask yourself, what do I do much better than my friends? And it would be, you know, I'm great at decor, or I'm a really good host, or I am, you know, I'm great with baking sourdough, which I'm like not great at. And don't only think about, okay, am I going to sell sourdough bread now? But think about, can I teach other people how to make sourdough breads? And there are different routes to monetize something. But like really, it doesn't have to be what you studied. It can really also be something that you're very passionate and that you're really good at. So I would say, like, what am I good at? What do I enjoy doing? And what are people willing to pay for? If you find an overlap between those things, try different routes and see what the market needs. I would say test something and get feedback and perhaps start like a blog or an Instagram page and then see what people are. At the start, I had 180 followers and I literally just put so many stories on. What do you want to learn more about? Ask me questions, blah, blah, blah. And then I started to get a feel. I mean, I would never, ever have thought this is the way it's going to turn out. Never. I thought I would do like paid sponsored like posts and things, and this is how I would monetize it. But then I've actually never ever done any paid posts on my page. So I actually always say no to any paid things because I want to be like super true to what I want to post and not being paid to post something. And so I just want to say, like, be open-minded. Like, there is no way you're going to know now what it's going to look like in a year's time from now. Just take the first step and see what works and see what people like and see what you enjoy and what you're good at and kind of like figure your way out like that. I don't know. Yes. That's not a very specific answer.
No, it's so helpful. There's so many points that I want to touch on, because if I just chat to my friendship group, we majority between the ages 38 and 42, whenever we have a girls weekend away or a dinner, and the conversation that always comes up is, I want to do something else. I don't want to work for someone else, but what do I do? And I think their minds immediately go to, yeah, but how do I monetize that? And like you just said, you started something new thinking that you were going to monetize it in a completely different avenue. And then as things unfolded, look at what you're doing now. So I think we mustn't get too stuck on, and that's where I think I love chatting and in encouraging people to become entrepreneurs, because you sometimes just have to be like blindly ignorant and just have this self-belief and just, like you said, take the first step. But don't also underestimate that you can start off with your sourdough as a side hustle. It might not kick off. That so-called inverted commas failure might have led you to learn other things or networked and found other opportunities of who you can work with and what you can actually do and monetize.
Exactly. And that network is, don't underestimate that, because you're going to, and then people might introduce you to someone else and you might end up doing something with someone that you met because you started something.
Completely.
And I think there are two things that really helped me overcome most of this, like, what do I do? I don't know what to do. It's due to fear. Actually, if you go and break it down to the basic layers, then most of that is actually fear of failure, fear of judgment, fear of, there are so many fears that I read this book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And that was a big, big, big mindset shift that helped me to start this business. But the other thing is I started talking to my psychologist and I'm like, there is nothing wrong with me. I'm a smart lady. I have security and financial backing from my parents if I need to. Why the hell am I so afraid of starting something? And why is there such a big barrier? So we started working through the fears, and just she's basically not forcing me, but encouraging me to take small steps, right? Make that post and don't worry, like try to not worry what people say about it. And this other thing is, I worked with my husband and I said, we're going to have a meeting every Sunday. Here are 10 business ideas that I have. The first one was actually a gown business, like selling gowns that are made from like silky gowns that you can actually wear in a Zoom call and that's comfortable. So for people working from home, it looks nice on top, but it's still comfy. And I started working on getting patterns and then finding suppliers. And then the personal finance option blog, it was a personal finance blog, was down, like, I think number 7 on my list. And when I went through these ideas, we met every Sunday, my husband and I, and just discussed the business ideas. I wanted to find that page somewhere, but I couldn't. And then we would say, okay, this is what I've done so far on this one, this one, this one. And we started treating it, I think this is like super important, is treating every item on that list as a side hustle instead of treating it as my identity. And because a lot of people get so stuck and say, oh, but if I'm going to launch a sourdough business, then I'm going to be the sourdough person. And if this doesn't work, then everyone's going to see me as the failure. But that's just one project. Like, you are in your life a project of 10. You're a project of being a mom, a project of being a wife, project of cooking at home, a project of, you know, what you dress, if you like styling yourself. There are many projects in your life. You don't have to. It's okay if one of them doesn't work out. Like, it's just a project. It's not your whole new identity. And I really struggled with that because I thought that everyone's going to be like, oh, wow, she started this page. It's a massive failure. No one's following her. No one's commenting on her posts. Yes. And it doesn't have to be your identity. It can just be like a little project that you're testing out.
That's very powerful. All the nodding in the back. No, that's very powerful. And something that I also, I can't remember if it was a podcast or a video that I watched, but it was also very encouraging. And it actually ties back to when you were saying that you had your Instagram and your first post that went out, is feel out your audience with these ideas. You also mentioned it, but whether it's friendship groups, whether you've got a Facebook page or Instagram page, and whether you've got 108 followers, often we spend so much time on perfecting the product or the service, the look and feel, the image, the everything. And then we launch something that just, it's crickets. Or what often happens, someone's got an idea and then they've got no bloody idea. There's someone else that's already there, that product or service already exists, and they've spent hours on trying to build something instead of just doing the research first. So I'm involved now with another startup, and the most exciting part is the person wanting to start it is very hung up on the look, the feel, the image, because every product that is launched in the same space in this industry, it's so appealing. The design is amazing. The story behind it is amazing. But I'm reverting back. Like, there's too much clutter, too much noise. Simplify, get a product out there, test it, get the service out there, test it, get the testimonials. Like, you don't even need a fancy website to start a business and start monetizing it. Again, you can go back to social media, do an awful first post. You can archive it in the future. You can delete it in the future, but just get yourself and your idea out there and get the feedback going, because that's how it's going to grow.
Yeah, and a big, big, I think mistake there, I don't want to call it a mistake because then people might think, oh, now I'm making mistakes. Rather, the big misconception is that you're comparing yourself to someone that's 10 years down the line. You can't look at my page and say, oh, my videos are not as nice as hers. Yeah, but I'm already 18 months in. I've like tested 3 video editors. I have a team of people helping me now. You can't compare your first post. Like, go look at my first post if you want to compare. You can't, like this startup, you can't compare their product to someone that is already 20 years established, right? Like, you can't have the same look and feel. You don't have that capacity, the team, the time. You have to start somewhere, and it's really like you can't expect it or compare it to someone that's 5 or 10 years ahead.
Totally. And even though you're a year and a half in, you are how many years in experience,
exactly,
MBA, everything else. Okay, so any practical tips for moms to automate sort of savings and investments? So managing fluctuating family expenses, I put a note here, cut down on Willys and Country Road. But no, just going back to that, that's actually something, again, why I'm so much more confident in talking about investing now, is because we've made it such a interesting topic of conversation for my husband and I. So monthly, we are actually talking about investments. We are looking at our investment portfolio. Not, we also passive investors, but it also is, I'm still learning a hell of a lot. So it's nice to check in, him guiding me. He's never making me feel stupid, which is amazing and so empowering. And we're sending each other articles about it. So I think, yeah, going back to my question, that was what I was going to say. Sorry, this is definitely postpartum brain. But we've started treating our goals with finance and investing like we do our exercise. And you know how much we love that. And it's our habits. So part of our habits of waking up in the morning, working out, or incorporating it into our lifestyles, we've done the exact same thing when it comes to finance. We've got a few habits, a few like rituals that we do to make chatting about money a lot more less... I suppose overwhelming. I think when I used to talk about money, I'd get a bit heated and emotional, especially even in my current relationship now. And now I feel a lot more, less emotionally attached and being able to talk about it. Now I've gone off on a tangent. I want to go back to...
No, but before you go back, I actually want to think, when I mention is something is that if you become a passive investor, you understand the concept of being an index investor and that you're actually just tracking the average of the market. It's so amazing because you actually realize this is kind of out of your hands. What you're doing is just tracking the average of the market as close as possible. By avoiding unnecessary fees, you're just tracking the market. So whether it goes down or up, that shouldn't be upsetting to you. Like, dealing with volatility is a long-term thing that you will learn. It is one of the things that you have to deal with to become a successful stock market investor. But you actually realize that you don't have to stress. It shouldn't be a fight between the two of you at the end of the month because the stock market is down. And, oh, but you said we should invest in this. No, because this is actually the average of the market. You need to deal with volatility. And let's not blame each other for this and not say, oh, but you said we should choose this one. Or even if it's with an advisor, no, but that advisor is not acting, they don't have the inside knowledge that we thought they would, because why is the stock market, the portfolio down? That's actually just the market. Like, you don't have any control over the market. What you can control is how much you invest every month and how consistent you are, and also not withdrawing your money when the market is down, because that's also a mistake that people make. Because when the market is down, that's actually when you should like put even more money in. But I don't want to say like try to time the market, rather just stick to that is probably like to answer your question that you asked earlier, is how do you make it fit into your life a little bit easier. So I would when I started earning a proper salary, well, first of all, that was in London, and I definitely didn't know what I was doing on investing. In Switzerland, after my MBA, I started really earning a good salary. Then I had a commitment in my budget every month, like rent, to pay money into my investment portfolio. So a lot of people will call this paying yourself first before you pay someone else. So with my debit order into the rent account, rental or the landlord's account, I also had a debit order into my investment portfolio account. So it or my brokerage account. So it literally went off as a debit order at the start of the month. And I knew I can only spend what's left after. So that kind of, there's no choice about it. You don't see, oh, is this going to be a spendy month and then I can invest what's left? No, I will actually invest first and then I can spend what's left. I think that's probably one tip. And the other thing is also, if you're going to start a business, Like my business that I started is probably one of the most rewarding, but also financially rewarding things I've done. But it took some capital initially to put into the business. And that should also be seen as an investment. So especially if you're getting started and your cash flow is quite tight and you're like, okay, but I can't, should I put my money towards my investing or my business? I think it's okay to at least then say, okay, I'm going to try for 6 months and I'm going to put my cash into my business, or longer. Don't think like 6 months is like the timeline, that's quite short, but 6 months. And then, okay, later I'm going to start again and open up my investment portfolio. So investing does not only have to be in stocks. It can also be in yourself and in a business. But like, you know, like Botox treatments is Barbara, it's probably not investing in yourself.
You can,
I don't know.
You can invest a lot of money if you save on your Botox, right? Yeah. You can max out your tax-free savings account if you put your beauty treatments just for the year. That's That's actually one of our rules in our house is by March, April latest to start like max out our following year's tax-free savings account, because too many times it would come to December and we haven't. And then, I mean,
tempting to do something else with the money.
Yes, and who can then in January put it away, and then Feb's a short month. So maybe max out your tax-free savings account for the year and then invest in your business side hustle and then invest in your beauty treatments. Or, which is going to lead me to the next question, if you are in a relationship, get your partner to invest in your beauty treatments so that you can invest. Because that's my other question is, we've got single moms listening who, how do they take those steps in sort of investing, or any advice there? And then also we've got people listening where the husband, I know you've touched on this on a video before, but perhaps the woman's, I'm just completely just stereotyping here, but her salary's going into, you know, groceries, expenses, and husband's going into the rest of the expenses for the month. How do they, is it a conversation to have with their husband? I know you've got your couples retreat coming up this weekend, which is very beneficial for so many. But yeah, any advice in those two scenarios? So solo mom, and also the partnership.
I think it's, let me touch on the solo mom first. That's, I mean, so much respect for solo moms. I think that's an extremely hard job to do. And if you are then responsible for the finances and emotional support for kids and also working full time, I can imagine like it's not an easy thing. I just want to say respect. And then the next thing to mention there is, I think that it would be good for a solo mom to get an accountability partner, to get someone, either a friend or a family member, to say, you know, I need some support to discuss my finances with on a monthly basis. Like, can we have a money date? Obviously someone that you trust and feel comfortable with, but to say, can we meet on a monthly basis? And I just want to run my numbers past you, and to, like, on the first date, we look at my current investments that I have, and let's try and identify the fees or see what it's invested in, and also try to project what this is going to look like in a few years from now, to know whether this is actually sufficient for my retirement or for my kids' education or whatever the purpose is of that. And also seeing, okay, but how can we rework my budgets in a way? Perhaps can we look at this together to see if there is a way that I can free up some money to make more investments? And if we can sit together, I want to kind of also just have a moment to reflect and to perhaps brag of what I've achieved in this month with my money. I think it's really great to have someone that you can sit with and look, and it can be a friend, and it can be, I mean, my sister and I used to do this a lot, where we'd kind of actually compete a bit on our investments to say who's grown their portfolio the most. That's one thing. And then the other thing is on the, if you're in a relationship that's very much stereotypical in a way where the husband is responsible for the investments and you actually have no idea what it's invested in. This happens like way more often than we would think or expect in the same age. But I just don't want to make it like a judgment zone. Oh my word, how do you not know what you're invested in? Because I think it's really, really common. And some women would tell me that they have an advisor, a family advisor, but the advisor only talks to the husband. So I would, ask if I can be invited to these meetings, if I can see what the money is being invested in, and show some curiosity. And I actually had a woman tell me once, but my husband doesn't, like, my husband said, why don't you trust me? Why can't I just do this myself? But honestly, I think it's an amazing thing to learn more about. And it's going to take time. You're not going to become an expert overnight. But just start looking at what it's invested in and start learning a bit and compare it to to other investments to see, okay, our portfolio returned 10%, the S&P 500 returned 15%, and start comparing it so that you can have an idea of a benchmark, even like how do you know whether your investments are doing well? You have to compare it to something. I think that's probably the best.
And then if we look at, again, I know most of our listeners also have got financial advisors. So maybe just a little, I would say I love watching when you share more about it. And I know you said you've got lots of videos on it when it comes to fees. But maybe just some things to look out for or to question your advisor. Because again, when I got a financial advisor, I think I was 22 at my first job. And it was my colleague had a financial advisor. And I thought, this is quite something that has to be done. It didn't even come from my family or parents, but I was way too insecure to ask even how much where they get their fees for, what the fees are, where they get their interest from. None of that. I didn't understand that, and it was only later that I realized that a lot of the times financial advisors are obviously just selling the products that they get. They get a
commissions
cut
off. Yeah.
Yes. So maybe just touch on that.
Yeah, I think that it is. I've obviously become like a person that's not very liked by financial advisors because of my opinion on this. And by the way, I also have to say that not all advisors are like this. It's also an industry where, as an advisor, if you want to make a living, unfortunately, that means you have to take money from your clients' investments. And this is how they either get paid in commissions or they get paid in ongoing fees. And unfortunately, this is the way that they're going to have to make a living. And my whole opinion is, but don't just cut that part out. Don't pay unnecessary. Don't give away any of your money to someone else. Rather, just hold as much of that to yourself as possible. Mm-hmm. Because even with a 1% fee over a 40-year timeline, that could cost you 20% of your portfolio in opportunity, like lost opportunity cost. Because you are basically, you could have reinvested all of that money. If they take 1% away from your portfolio every year, that's like actually a significant amount of money that you are not reinvesting. And for the compounding equation, which is exponential growth, to work properly, you need to maximize the amount of money that you reinvest in your portfolio to get exponential growth. For every 1% that you give away to someone, that means over a 40-year timeline, 20% less value compared to what you could have had if you just had everything reinvested. So this is why I say it's so crucial to learn how to do this yourself and to cut out any unnecessary flows that you don't need. And then a lot of people say, yeah, but I wouldn't know what to do if it weren't for the advisor. So any growth I get is thanks to them. And you can spend 6 weeks to learn how to do this yourself and then get all of that growth for yourself. I've heard more horror stories than success stories when it comes to working with advisors. And when one girl, similar to your story, signed up with her advisor to a policy, I think when she was like 21 years old, she worked for one of the big banks in South Africa, funny enough, and the advisor never spoke to her again. I think it's 14 or 15 years, never spoke to her. She checked in on that policy. He was taking his commission and his fee every single month, and he was linked to her policy. She's never spoken to him since. So she has missed out on so much growth over the last 14 years and never even spoken to the guy again after being sold that product. And yeah, I just think that there, unfortunately, it is a business where salesmen do really well. Because if you, as an advisor, you dress up nicely, you drive a fancy car, you can go and sit in someone and like, I have all the investing secrets, just ask me and I can tell you how you can make money. And it's unfortunately the case that you're going to think, oh, wow, but they know probably much more than me. Yeah. They can use some fancy words and terms that you don't understand. And then you're just so intimidated, you don't know what to ask. So I would always say, ask about, well, go and watch some of my videos. It's hard to explain in a podcast, right? But ask for your effective annual cost. They should, by law, disclose that to you. I've also had a lot of people say, but they don't want to disclose it. It's been so hard. For 2 months I've been asking and they're not telling me.
Oh, gosh, isn't that scary? So the money is sitting with them.
Yeah, exactly. And they're not responding because they're very nice when you're talking about investing and giving them money. But once you start asking about the fees, then they're not responsive. That's like a massive red flag. Anyway, I also think that if you want to use someone, like this is very, very important to note, is rather just pay for an hourly session. Mm. Ask your advisor, can I just pay you for this hour? and you help me. And I can bring my laptop and we can do something together. But I can promise you a lot of them are going to say no, because this is not a lucrative business for them to be. And they want to be in the business where they can take fees from you every single month rather than just you paying them for that consultation session. And I like to compare this to going to a doctor. Like, imagine you had a knee replacement where you say, okay, the doctor is, you're going to pay the doctor. You have two options. You're going to pay the doctor for the surgery, the knee replacement surgery, or you're going to pay a subscription fee for the rest of your life because they replaced the knee for you. It's obviously going to be in your interest to rather just say, okay, I'm going to do this once off and fix the knee, you know, rather than just paying you for the rest of my life. I think you should treat your advisor in the same way. Yeah. Give me, help me, let's do a financial plan. I'll pay you for 6 hours if I must, but I don't want to pay you for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And also, I think with when it came to my financial advisor back then, I parted ways when I realized I couldn't do any investments offshore. And that's when I started to question, okay, but then how is this portfolio best for my, for me, personalized for me? Or what, of course, that's when I looked in deeper into fees and what they were suggesting. But I think also just to interject there, if it, with anyone who has a financial advisor, especially if they've got a good relationship with them, it's not saying immediately cut ties. Maybe if this is something that you aren't doing yourself and you just need the confidence, opening up that, sorry, I'm just going to say Easy Equities because I don't, I'm not that knowledgeable, but the rest of them, but opening up an Easy Equities account, getting confident, starting with a demo account. And only then, that's actually something I did. Only after I understood, in like a, to a certain extent, managing my own investments and my own tax-free accounts, that's when I parted ways, because I had a bit more confidence. And then I could go, actually, okay, withdraw the money and let's put it all into my control.
You know, it's a common problem that people have that work with an advisor, because they build really good relationships with them. And now they ask me, but I want to break up with them. How do I do that? Many times it's family friends. They did your parents' investments. Now they're doing your investments. So how do you break up with them? Because now you want to start doing it yourself. This is actually like a really common thing. So there are a few tips that I would say is, don't try to negotiate on fees. Don't say, hey, I actually want to do this myself because I realize the fees I'm paying you is not worth it for me in the long term. Sorry, so you can actually say is, rather than paying you, don't negotiate on fees, because then they can come back and say, but I'm going to cut your fee. And ultimately what you actually want to do is completely get rid of the fee and start just doing it yourself. So don't go into a fee war. And the other thing is to just kind of be honest and say is, I started learning a lot and I feel confident that I want to take control of this myself. And now I just want to take control of my investments. And for this reason, I want to liquidate my portfolio. Or also, if someone really has your best interest at heart, then they would celebrate a moment like this. And this is where the true colors usually start to show, because then they're going to say, scare you off. Rather than scaring you off, ask if you can, hey, can I pay you for an hour consultation? I want to move my investments away. I want to start doing this myself. Yeah. If they really have your best interest at all, then they should celebrate the fact, rather than saying, I almost want to guarantee that the discussion is probably not going to go well. But sometimes it is family. And if it's family, like most of the advisor, not all of them have bad intentions. Some of them actually just don't know about index investing. And
but a lot of them are also reliant on it. Yes, because and that's their livelihood. So you, on the other hand, if it is a family member, like you say, it's so common, you really feel emotionally tied to it. But there are ways of exiting.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I want. It's possible to break up.
100%. Yeah. okay, and then just to touch on maybe some tools, whether it's apps, books, Financial Times, subscriptions, anything, top three that you'd suggest for maybe just most of us wanting to invest, just to get more familiar about what ETFs, I know we haven't even touched on that, or individual shares, or where to start, anything that can be a resource basically for you.
I think that, so there's this one book I always talk about called The Psychology of Money, and it's by Morgan Housel. You can get it in South Africa and you can easily get it in London as well, wherever you are. It is an amazing book on not just investing. He talks a little bit about investing. He talks about stock market volatility and also how he invests his own money. Funny enough, he used to be a writer for a platform that enables stock picking. So he used to write about stocks and do research on stock picking to show people like, oh, that you should now buy this stock, or we project this growth, and it's paid subscription platform. I don't want to mention the name because I don't want people to start doing it because I'm not a fan of stock picking. Yes. I think it's like a little bit like gambling. But it's funny enough, he used to write, he was one of their biggest writers. And then he writes in his book that he just invests in index funds. He owns his house and he owns index funds and that's all he invests in. And he has a significant chunk of cash, where normally I say don't hold too much cash. You should invest most of it. But anyway, I think that's a great book to start with. But also, I have like a lot of great YouTube videos that you can watch. But there's this guy that called Ben Felix on YouTube. He has amazing, but it's much more complex. So if you're a little bit more into the complexity of investments and how index funds work and why index funds aren't a bubble, a lot of people will say, but that's a bubble. Like, go and read that. Also, why you shouldn't be focusing on certain industries. Like, a lot of people want to just invest in tech now because tech has performed really well over the last 20 years. So then people want to focus on just investing in the NASDAQ index, for example, that tracks US tech. And he talks about why you shouldn't put focuses on certain industries. Anyway, that's an amazing channel to go. And also, he has got some more simple videos to look at. Yeah, I think those are like my go-to guys. I'm sure that there must be people that also do simpler videos, but...
It would be interesting to know, and if anyone listening, they can sort of send us a message, or if they're more local podcasts who also touch on it. I know Rich Habits in the States, that's a podcast that I love to listen to. They've actually also got a really interesting one on your financial advisor. And I think if you listen to that and watch your videos, it will change a lot of people's perception.
Oh, that's great. Okay. I should actually go and watch that
one. I'm going to share it with you.
I think that also, I wanted to say something about the advisors. No, I forget now.
It will come back to you. Just to wrap it all up. Okay. Back to, so tax-free savings, you can hang on to your RA, that you wouldn't necessarily prioritize that if you can be taking more into your own control. So tax-free savings, looking at things like ETFs, or if you can explain that a bit more for those that aren't too familiar. I'm trying to dumb it down because I'm trying to think of like what everyone else listening, especially when if you've never heard these things before and you're not seeing it in front of you, it might sound even more overwhelming. So you are a big promoter of sort of funds, a safer option than individual shares. Maybe just touch on that before we move on.
Sure. I think a lot of people think when you talk about investing, it's like analyzing stocks and companies and financials and a lot of numbers and how can I do that? And that's like not at all what I'm about. So all the data is there around how hard it is to beat the market average in the long term. And this is really the concept of index investing. So an index is basically a list of stocks, let's say an S&P 500 index. You'll hear S&P 500 a lot because this is the most popular index in the world, and it tracks the US stock market or the 500 largest companies in the US, which is the biggest stock market in the world. So therefore, that's the reason that it's also the most popular. And a lot of people then think, okay, but which one should I buy, or how does it work? So it literally is a list of the 500 biggest companies in the US, where you can become a part owner in each of those 500 companies by buying an ETF, which is an exchange-traded fund. It's a complex term to just say it's a basket of stocks. So it's a basket of stocks that represents the 500 largest companies in the US. And it changes as those companies change, it's a dynamic list. So as something happens, if one of the companies at the bottom shrink because they're not competitive anymore and it's replaced by a new one, then the 500 list is a dynamic one. Or if one that's at the top has, Apple, Amazon, or Tesla, for example, is going through a little bit of turmoil at the moment, then it would move a little bit lower down the list and have less. It's also allocated within ratio to their market cap, which is the value of the company. Mm-hmm. So then you have less exposure to those companies as they shrink, or more exposure as they grow in value. It's almost like a complete hands-off way for you to say, I'm just going to track the 500 largest companies in the US, and I'm going to passively, I'm going to say, trust the index to do its job. Because then if you go look at historic, obviously we can't use historic performance as an indicator of future performance, but the stock market continues to grow in the long term. So for you, it's just really a time game, making sure that you're in the market long enough and not hoping that you're going to become, it's not like the lotto. You're not going to become a millionaire overnight by putting some money into it. It's really like a long-term game and consistently putting money in. But in terms of the S&P 500, that would you can literally, there are hundreds of ETFs that achieve the exact same thing of just tracking that index. Many people become overwhelmed by choosing the right one then. And really the thing that you can look out for is the fees, the total expense ratio, which describes the fee on the fund. And it's usually around, in the US, you've got super cheap ones. They're 0.03% fees, which is really low. In South Africa, you'll get 0.27% to 0.58%, the last time I checked. So that range is a little bit more expensive than the US, but it's not significant enough for me to say it's not worthwhile. Mm-hmm. Especially because if you're in South Africa, you've got rands, it's easier to invest in an ETF here in rands. And you literally just look at the fee, you know, that total expense ratio. Don't look at the price tag, because a lot of people confuse and say, but we've got three options here. This one is, the price is 99, this one is 89, and this one is 109. So I should obviously choose the cheapest one. So that's really like not the case. The price is irrelevant. The price is really just indicative of the size of the pizza, the piece of the pizza. So if it's cheaper, you've got a smaller piece of pizza, then it means you have to buy two to get the same slice or the same size of pizza slice as someone that is buying a bigger slice at a higher price. So the price is irrelevant. So the fees are the important thing to look for. But they are all really much of the same, to be honest. Yes, there are a lot of like other details that we can, tracking errors and things, but don't like get analysis paralysis. Really just like, you can probably not go wrong. It's a competitive market. The fees are also not that different, to be honest.
And then also the nice thing with your tax-free savings account, you could actually also invest in those ETFs like you mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the important part is like TFS, people confuse, they think tax-free savings account means it's a savings account. It's actually an investing account. You can invest that money. You can, that is also, I think we should also just probably touch on the RA versus TFSA again, but you can invest that money and you can choose exactly what you invest. You have complete freedom over what it's invested in, except for you can't do single stocks. There is some limitation, but you can do 100% offshore investment. So you can invest in foreign ETFs. You don't have to do it all in SA, where an RA has a different limitation. And also you can go 100% high risk, like equities with it. And I guess, okay, let's get back to the RA TFSA, but I want to just mention about the stock picking thing, is because a lot of people think that they're going to beat the market in the long term. And I was one of those people. I used to do stock picking, and I had some wins, but I also had some losses. And people always just tell you about their wins. They're not going to tell
it's
you
like
about
gambling.
They're not going to tell, exactly. They're not going to tell you about their losses. And if you go look at, I mean, there is a lot of on this, but Warren Buffett is a very, very big believer of the S&P 500. And he says 90% of his wife's inheritance is going to go into the S&P 500. This is the wealthiest, one of the wealthiest investors in the world. And he has access to the best advisors in the world. And still his wife's money will go into an S&P 500 ETF. So then you should all start questioning, okay, but if this guy is the biggest investor in the US, why is he not using some advisor? He actually put a bet out, a very famous bet. I've got a few videos on this, but in 2007, where he invited a bet or someone to take on the bet on the S&P 500, saying that a hedge fund manager will not, any hedge fund can take him on, you'll not be able to beat the S&P 500 over the next 10 years. And he only had one party willing to take this bet on. So what this basically means is a hedge fund is picking stocks. So they do long and short, which is a complex thing, but they also win they can also win in a way when the market goes down. They don't only win when the market goes up in value. They can buy complex instruments that do the reverse. But basically, he just said, I mean, all of you guys selling your expensive funds, having like all this amazing marketing material, please take me up on this offer. I want to see if you can beat the average of the market over 10 years. And I think you can't. One guy came forward, he selected selected four funds and then said, okay, I'm taking you up as $1 million bet. And it was, the S&P 500 outperformed those four funds by 4x, four times. So the S&P 500 was more than 120%, and that fund was 36% over that 10-year, four funds, 36% average return. So it's just like an insanely big difference. Wow. And this is to think someone that knew what was you know, at stake,
yes,
a very public bet. And, you know, you would argue it's one of the biggest stock pickers in the world, the best stock pickers in the world are in the US, you would assume, right? And they still couldn't beat the S&P 500. This is why an average Joe like me and you are not going to beat the market average by trying and picking stocks, because it's nice to like buy a stock and thinking, oh, it's gone up. But selling it is the hard part, because you don't know when should you sell to lock your returns in, and then where do you go with that money? Anyway.
So true. I'm feeling very confident about my investments right now.
Okay.
Okay. So now, so we've touched a bit on the free sort of content that you've got out there, the videos, your YouTube channel, all of that people can sort of tune into and learn more. Anything else coming up that you would like to sort of recommend, especially those very hungry to learn a bit more from you?
Yeah, sure. So I have my flagship investing course is what I call it now. So it's a 5-week course. It will probably change into a 6-week course by the end of this year. We run that about 4 times a year. So we'll do that in the next 2 or 3 months again. And that is an amazing, guaranteed kind of you're going to love it course. I would always say join that if you're really keen on starting and becoming a DIY investor. I literally give you everything that you need to know. And it's amazing. Then also we are working on new courses. So that's really exciting. We're developing one with couples now so that we can help you as a couple determine what your values are around money, what you're prioritizing, setting goals together, getting your budgets in order, and really just giving you a game plan as a couple to work on money together. Then we are developing an array of other courses as well. So I would definitely say follow me on Instagram or sign up to my blog so that you can be informed of when these things happen. It's really an exciting time and I love it.
It shows. I think also the very successful entrepreneurs that I've chatted to and even the ambitious women that I work one-on-one, they are so successful because they absolutely love what they do, but they're giving back. Being an act of service that's really, really helping. And I see there's just so much value. To end off, this is a question that we often ask, and I think it's very relevant because we're talking about investments and spend, but what is the most outrageous and expensive health investment that you've made, and was it worth it?
So I asked my husband what if you ask me something like this, what I can say. and then he said, tell them a future boob job.
That he's going to invest in. That's going to be the husband's expense for sure.
I asked him, okay, if I say that, you should ask me in future because then it's going to be a boob job. No, but okay, I'm joking. That's probably not a health investment. I think that he also said I should not say Botox because that's not an appropriate aesthetic. So a biggest fail, I would say, is a Whoop subscription. I've mentioned this on my Instagram. Yes. Is that we got Whoop. My husband and I both got Whoops. He's obsessed because he loves
data-driven.
Yeah, very data-driven, and also OCD on data. Oh, my sleep score is up 2% compared to yesterday.
Yes,
and
yes.
I had a Whoop as well. I still have it. It's in my drawer. It's just lying there. And it's just too much. I already spend so much time on my phone. I just don't want to wake up every day and then try to analyze all of this data on my phone for 20 minutes. Yeah. Also, filling out a questionnaire every morning on different things like alcohol, child in bed, did you stand up through the night, etc. That's too much for me. I just need my step tracker, and that's all I want. I also probably am not the typical very health committed or fitness person, which I guess other people would not want more from their watches than I do. That's probably something else to chat about, but I feel like I've really neglected that part of my life over the last 18 months in starting this business because I just feel like I cannot juggle everything. I really struggle. The best investment I've made is CrossFit in London. When we lived in London, we joined a CrossFit gym close to our house. It was super expensive in pound terms, I think £180, which is more than R3,500 a month. And it was so worth it. Just being forced every morning to go there. You don't have to think about a program. You know someone else is going to look after this for you. It was probably the best thing I've spent money on. And if I lived close to a CrossFit gym or anything of that kind where there's a group program and weight training involved because I love weight training, then I would definitely join it again. It's so, so worth the money.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for your time. I think we could have gone on for another hour or two, but I think there's so much value and you're doing an incredible job.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Thank you, Ella.
Thanks for listening to the Fit Mom Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, it would mean so much to us if you could subscribe, rate, and share this episode with a fellow ambitious fit mom. Chat soon.